Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck. The White House is painting a dire picture for every region in the nation, including Wyoming, if action is not taken to combat climate change. But Matt Laszlo reports from Washington that the state's Republican senators still are not buying it.
Things won't be looking pretty in Wyoming and the surrounding states if the latest White House climate assessment is right. You can expect intensified floods, droughts, and winter or spring storms. Julian Boggs of Environment America says the White House report paints a full picture of a nation rapidly changing due to rising temperatures.
These are things that folks are experiencing every day. And the National Climate Assessment is also unique not only in the specificity of the impacts, but it's unique in that it shows region by region how folks are experiencing this. So in the Mountain West, more extreme wildfires.
But those predictions are being brushed aside by Wyoming's policymakers here in the nation's capital. The state senior senator, Mike Enzi, says the dire predictions in the report don't mesh up with facts on the ground.
I barely made it back here because of a May snowstorm in Wyoming. It got 18 inches in Cheyenne. It's a little hard to convince Wyoming people there's global warming. We have 186% of normal snowpack. That's global warming.
As for the science behind man-made climate change and the overwhelming number of scientists who say it's fact, not fiction, Enzi says he thinks the debate has become a waste of money on both sides.
We're paying about $5 billion a year to prove that there's climate change and $5 billion a year to prove there isn't climate change. I'd rather have us put $10 billion a year into ideas that would solve climate.
One of the loudest voices in the Senate calling for action to combat global warming is Rhode Island's Sheldon Whitehouse. He says lawmakers from Wyoming and surrounding states aren't dumb. He just thinks they've been bought by the oil and gas industry.
I think it's less of a mindset towards science than it is a mindset towards the fossil fuel industry and the big polluters.
Enzi says the shoe is actually on the other foot. From his perch, President Obama is less concerned about nature than he is with appeasing his environmental supporters.
I don't see him as trying to control pollution. I see him as trying to put business out of business. I don't think they've figured out where tax dollars come from yet.
It's become a jobs debate on both sides of the political spectrum. The White House climate report argues the economy will lose jobs in the future if something drastic isn't done quickly to combat climate change. Wyoming Junior Senator John Barrasso calls that claim misguided in the short term.
It seems to me that the president's efforts on the environment actually are bad for the jobs climate in America, bad for the climate of families who realize the cost of energy is going to go up as a result of his proposals.
The White House has given up on trying to convince lawmakers like Enzi and Barrasso that climate change is real, happening, and bringing devastating consequences with it. In the coming weeks, administration officials are pushing through a new EPA rule that will drastically curb emissions from new power plants. In spite of a Supreme Court ruling that says Congress gave the EPA that authority under the Clean Air Act, Barrasso maintains the president is usurping American voters because he couldn't muster a 60-vote, filibuster-proof majority when he had 60 Democrats in the Senate.
Well, once again, the president seems to want to go around Congress, go beyond the original intent of legislation, and even when he had complete control of the House and the Senate with 60 senators, he wasn't able to get what he wants to do passed through Congress, and he shouldn't go around Congress.
And even though Barrasso opposes the president's climate agenda, he says it wouldn't change the weather even if the president got all he wanted.
No matter what the United States does, if Russia, India, China continue in what they're doing, emissions are going to continue to go up. And before Barack Obama became president, U.S. emissions have been dropping, but not around the world. So it seems that there is a significant cost to our economy, to our jobs, and to our own country's competitiveness globally if we do what Barack Obama wants to do, and I don't think it's good for America.
But Julian Boggs, that environmentalist from earlier, says Barrasso's attitude represents a strange new form of American defeatism.
It's interesting to see folks who say that America can't lead, that America shouldn't be the leader. When has America wanted to take a back seat and not a leading role in solving the climate crisis? First off, we should be leading on this issue. Second off, the United States is a huge emitter of carbon. We are the second largest carbon emitter in the world. What we do has a huge impact on the amount of carbon globally.
In the coming weeks, the EPA will unleash its new carbon rule, and it's expected to raise the temperature on Capitol Hill, at least when it comes to the Wyoming delegation. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Matt Laszlo in Washington.
The newly discovered abundance of domestic oil and gas is creating a shortage of something else: the petroleum engineers who regulate drilling activities. Government petroleum engineers approve companies' drilling plans and inspect wells after they're completed, to make sure that they're not at risk of contaminating water or blowing out. But as Wyoming Public Radio's Stephanie Joyce reports, there are just not enough petroleum engineers to go around.
Mark Watson is Wyoming's oil and gas supervisor, and he has a serious staffing problem on his hands. The Oil and Gas Commission is down to just two petroleum engineers, Watson and one with less than a year of experience. He's in the process of trying to hire three more.
And I just interviewed a girl who just graduated from the University of Wyoming, and she was offered a job with a major company for $105,000. And I thought, oh, I said, you're making $25,000 more than me, and I have 30 years' experience.
You heard that right. The state's top oil and gas regulator makes less than a recent college graduate working in industry. Watson says he's lobbying for increased starting salaries, but it's a long, bureaucratic process, and he has people to hire in the meantime. That's where the problems arise. Domestic oil and gas production is skyrocketing, but government regulators are hard to find.
When they're busy, we're busy, and we're competing for a limited source of skills and knowledge.
That's Michael Madrid. He's fluid minerals chief for the Bureau of Land Management in Wyoming and oversees hiring of the petroleum engineers who regulate drilling on federal land in the state. He says being short-staffed on the regulatory side is bad for everyone, including industry, since one of the engineers' responsibilities is processing new drilling applications.
The work will eventually get done, but there's long, significant delays if we're short-handed.
Right now, the BLM in Wyoming is actually mostly staffed, but there's concern about the future, and not just in Wyoming. A recent report by the Government Accountability Office says nationwide, BLM offices are facing staff shortages. Madrid says hanging on to people is a challenge when they can walk across the street and get a job that pays twice as much.
Don't have a good track record of retaining them. And it hurts when you've got someone who's finally got 4 or 5 years of experience and finally gets it, if you will, and then they leave.
Pay is one issue. The other is a wave of looming retirements. More than half of the BLM's petroleum engineers across the country will be eligible for retirement in 2017. It's a similar situation at the state level, and finding replacements for those retirees will be a challenge. Take Evan Lowry. He's a young, clean-cut petroleum engineering student at the University of Wyoming. He was recently relaxing at the hot springs in nearby Saratoga. He wasn't thinking about his career when a stranger tried to recruit him. The man turned out to be a petroleum engineer for the Department of the Interior.
And he was getting close to retirement, and he was talking about how they were looking for younger engineers.
What were some of his selling points?
Mainly benefits, I think, was the main thing that he emphasized as being the nice thing about working for the government.
Unfortunately, not a huge selling point for 20-somethings like Lowry.
The money is more motivating at this point, and he didn't mention that the industry does pay better.
The University of Wyoming is graduating more petroleum engineers these days after shutting down after the bust of the 1980s. For many decades, universities across the country graduated very few petroleum engineers. Then, fracking happened.
We started with 40 undergrad students in 2006, and now we are more than 300.
That's Vladimir Alvarado, the Associate Department Head for Petroleum Engineering at the University of Wyoming. He says no one is steering all those newly minted engineers towards regulatory jobs.
We do tell them that permitting is one of the big deals in industry. But we always think somebody else is going to do it, not themselves.
For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Stephanie Joyce.
Coming up, housing issues in Casper. This is Open Spaces. Welcome to Open Spaces. I'm Bob Beck. As the oil city, Casper has seen its fate closely tied with the energy industry, and the recent boom in production has seen Casper's population expand at an astounding rate. One thing not expanding fast enough, however, is affordable housing. Wyoming Public Radio's Jordan Geis reports.
Despite new commercial development, one thing in Casper you'll struggle to find are for sale and rent signs. With all the new energy work, people have poured into Casper, sometimes leaving little for the residents already there.
I was thinking like a 1 to 2 bedroom should be roughly $800 to $900, depending on how nice the place is.
That's Tad Steffensmeyer, a local resident of Casper who doesn't work in the energy industry and has been trying to find a place to live with his girlfriend and their cat for several months. Steffensmeyer says that rental prices are far higher than expected.
$1,200 to $1,400 on average for like a 2 to 3 bedroom house.
Prices have gone up because there's less housing and it's being snapped up by energy workers. Casper's Housing Authority has long been working to address the issue. Executive Director Kim Summerall Wright says it's much worse in Casper than she saw in Cheyenne when she was helping the state.
The Casper Housing Authority owns 75 public housing units. The Cheyenne Housing Authority owns 341. That puts us at a distinct disadvantage.
The housing shortage has driven up home prices and makes it difficult for residents to find homes. According to the Wyoming Department of Administration and Information, between 2000 and 2010, medium home prices went up 110%. Wright says it continues to grow.
Especially on the low end, housing is getting more and more expensive. I'm not sure when we decided as a state that $175,000 is an affordable home. One of the challenges we have is we have people on rental assistance that are professionals that are working in their field. They have bachelor's degrees. They're actually working in their field, but they cannot afford to buy a home in Casper.
Young professionals aren't the only people affected. The Casper Housing Authority's Kim Perez says veterans have also been hit hard.
I believe a lot of it is because we have so many young people coming home from the war. Having worked with so many, one of the major things, their complaints or their frustration is that they really have nobody that understands what is going on with them right now. They want them to go into treatment.
Perez says some Casperites are beginning to tackle the issue. Steve Grimshaw and his wife have worked on the Wyoming National Apartments in Casper, which provides affordable housing to underprivileged citizens.
Steve and I have had the opportunity to talk a few times, and he believes the same as I do. Let's put them in new places. Let's make it shiny. Give them some pride in ownership. Hey, this is my place.
The Casper City Council has also been working to develop affordable housing while creating economic incentives for the city.
Our very first project is the Star Apartments. They have given us $480,000 to pay for the abatement and to help with that project. It is going to be between $8 and $9 million. That money will be coming in from outside the community and into the city of Casper. It's a wonderful project, something that would not have happened without the city council.
Still, the city has not kept pace with demands. According to the Department of Administration and Information, Casper's rent has jumped more than 12% in the last year. For residents like Tad Steffensmeyer, that's still a problem.
We're actually looking to move in with other people, so that we have other people looking around too. We would have to live with somebody else at this point to be able to afford to live on our own, I guess. We'd have to have a roommate or two.
City officials recognize that there's no quick fix, and it's going to take a while to mend the issue. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Jordan Geis.
Changing gears, the 6th annual Cheyenne International Film Festival kicks off on Tuesday. Alan Ohashi runs the event, and he joins us once again to tell us what is in store.
We show a variety of movies, shorts, feature-length, documentary, hopefully something that will be of interest to anyone who is interested in independent movies.
Now, where do most of these movies come from?
Well, this year we were really trying to focus in on movies that had something to do with Wyoming or Wyoming people. And so for the most part, they're Wyoming stories or somehow shot in Wyoming.
All right, I see. So tell me about some of them.
Let's see. Tuesday is a short film called Wyoming Americana, and it's a short documentary about three bands that are getting ready to go on this Wyoming Americana music tour. And one of the bands, Jay Shogren's band, will be performing a live and in concert after the movie. So that'll be kind of a mixed bag. Wednesday is a movie called The African Guest that was shot in Colorado and in the Cameroon, and it's a kind of a good guy, bad guy kind of story. And I was actually involved in that film, as well as lots of people involved in my organization. Thursday is co-sponsored by the Cheyenne Zombie Festival, and we'll be showing a bunch of zombie shorts and having a zombie reception of some sort.
And I saw that on the list. That caught my attention. So will those be Wyoming zombie movies as well?
Well, at least one of them will be. One of them is called Lily, and it was produced for the Shootout Cheyenne, and it was kind of a spooky zombie ghost-like theme to it. So we'll have one movie at least from Wyoming on that theme. Friday is sponsored by Body Lines Dance Theater, and they'll be doing a live ballet performance, and there'll be a movie called Ballerina, featuring some ballerinas from the Kirov Ballet in Russia. And the closing night will be Dan Youngie. He's a Cheyenne native who won an Oscar a couple years ago, and he'll be showing his newest movie called Fight Church, and that'll be on Saturday the 24th.
What's that about?
Well, it has something to do with the mixed martial arts and some line of spirituality and how those two kind of mesh together.
This is something when you started it a long time ago, it's the 6 years ago, it seems like it was just yesterday, but I know the idea was, as you said, to bring more independent film to Wyoming. Has it inspired filmmakers? Has it done that part of it?
Well, I think there's always been kind of a latent filmmaking community in Wyoming, but we've just been a platform for people to screen their work, provide an impetus to filmmakers this is something that you can do, and there are places where, you know, where you can show your movies.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that has been a positive evolution along with the existing filmmakers that currently, you know, reside in the state.
Yeah, I mean, it might be appropriate to also ask you about just your overall film efforts in Wyoming. This is just one piece of everything that you guys do. Could you talk a little bit about some of the other parts?
We were working with a company out of New York and kind of co-produced a movie that we shot up in Jackson last summer called Mahjong in the West. And we're hoping to show that at Cheyenne, but it's not quite ready yet, at least as near as I can gather. And that was a pretty big production. That was an actual, you know, independent studio production. I'm currently working on a project along with a group from the Northwest. It's called, it doesn't really have a title yet, but it's about Dutch hop dancing, which is a kind of a German, Volga, Russian cultural documentation project that's happening in Colorado, Wyoming, and Nebraska.
So as far as this this particular festival, the Cheyenne International Film Festival, if folks want to attend, what do they need to do to learn about it and to go?
We provide tickets online at www.ciff1.com, or they can buy them at the ticket office, which is at Phoenix Books and Music on Capitol Avenue in downtown Cheyenne.
Okay, and then these will be shown at what venue?
Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday will be at the what's called the Heinz Building Theater, and then Thursday, Friday, Saturday will be at the Atlas Theater.
Okay. Again, Alan Ohashi, always nice having you stop by and tell us about this, and hopefully you'll have a great turnout.
Yeah, thanks a lot for helping us out, Bob.
When we come back, we'll debut a story from our new Inside Energy partnership and hear from a University of Wyoming discus thrower who has high hopes this spring. This is Open Spaces. Welcome back to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck. A continuing energy boom in the Rocky Mountains and the northern Great Plains is reshaping the future of what's powering America. Today, we're launching a new reporting project called Inside Energy, teaming up with public radio and television stations in Colorado, Wyoming, and North Dakota to explore the complex energy issues affecting our lives. To start things off, reporter Dan Boyce catches us up on how the three states are feeling this new energy economy differently and how it's changing political realities.
Goins Elementary, the newest school in Cheyenne, Wyoming. Third graders are just filing back into Mrs. Drake's bright, high-ceilinged classroom to do some review.
We've been studying natural resources.
The kids have been learning about all the different types of energy their home state creates.
Hydropower.
We get energy by geothermal.
The renewable kinds and those sources you only get to use once.
Fossil fuels.
Right. Oil, natural gas, and the big one here, King Coal. It's a huge deal in Wyoming.
Most of those new school construction came from coal lease bonus payments.
This is Mark Gordon.
And I'm the Wyoming State Treasurer.
He's flipping through stacks of documents in his office.
There, that's the one I was looking for.
Statistics on the state's energy industry. At Inside Energy here, we've been studying the numbers. And per capita, Wyoming is the biggest energy producer in the country.
By far, by far.
And almost 75% of that production comes from coal. Coal taxes make up a massive portion of the state's general fund. It's a lot of eggs to put in the coal basket, especially the last few years.
There is a lot of concern, particularly short term, that coal is not in favor.
Demand for coal is trending downward, partly from concerns over and regulations on pollution, and because of the rise of America's newest energy gold rush, a gas and oil boom in places like the Bakken in North Dakota.
Hello?
Thomas Wilson joined the Army in 2008, served in Iraq.
I was a machine gunner.
He'd been working as a sheriff's deputy in Wyoming for the last year. That is, until a few weeks ago, when he took a job on an oil rig in North Dakota, starting out making $10 an hour more than he did at the sheriff's office. 2 weeks on, 2 weeks off.
It's hard to compete with a job where you only work half a year.
A lot of people like Wilson are pouring into North Dakota looking for opportunity. New fracking technologies have transformed the state in the last decade. GDP has more than doubled. Unemployment is the lowest in the nation. And that's created problems of its own. Housing, schools, roads, infrastructure. While officials in Wyoming are worrying about the future of coal, in North Dakota, they're trying to figure out how to manage explosive growth.
Good job, Kenzie!
In Colorado, it's yet another issue.
You got it, Kenzie. One more.
The fracking revolution and fracking wealth have come to this state too, but here, so much is happening right smack in the middle of town. Mini towns.
Final call, 400 meter relay.
I'm watching a middle school track meet at Northridge High School in Greeley, Colorado. And looking just about 400 feet off the southeast corner of the track, there stands this two-story wall of what looks like giant brown throw pillows. It's a sound dampening wall encircling a drilling operation.
We should be able to have some say in where they put these drilling locations.
Angela Kirkpatrick, along with a couple more concerned moms, look out over another proposed Greeley fracking site near their kids' elementary school.
We obviously don't want them that close to our children, and we don't want them in our backyards.
Five communities in Colorado have implemented outright bans on fracking, bans the state is challenging in court. Sarah Barwinski is another local mom. She says Greeley isn't looking to go as far as a ban.
We're an oil and gas town, and there's a lot of people whose livelihoods depend on this.
This tension between jobs, quality of life, and booming industry is exactly what we'll be exploring here at Inside Energy in the coming weeks and months. For Inside Energy, I'm Dan Boyce.
If you were paying close attention during the latest season of Downton Abbey, you might remember this exchange.
Is it really called the Teapot Dome Scandal? Seems so unlikely. What's it about?
What is it always about? Bribery and corruption. Taking money to allow private companies to drill for oil on government land.
That real scandal from the 1920s revolved around a real place in Wyoming, the Teapot Dome oil field. Now, 100 years later, those public lands are being auctioned off to the highest bidder. Wyoming Public Radio's Stephanie Joyce reports.
The turn off Highway 259 is unmarked. The only indication of where we are is a large sign warning that trespassing on this particular stretch of public land is a crime.
Okay, and this right here, we're going in the field right up here at this telephone pole.
That's Clark Turner. He oversees operations at Teapot Dome today. We're driving along the edge of the two-mile-wide field, past the bobbing heads of hundreds of wells. A ways up the road, he stops the car and points to a piece of wooden machinery held together by rusting metal.
First wells that were drilled out here in the 1920s were drilled with a rig like that.
The ancient rig is one of the last physical remnants of the scandal, but Turner says it looms large in other ways. Teapot Dome is the only oil field in the country operated entirely by government employees. The Department of Energy uses it mostly for testing new technologies, but these days the wells produce just a few barrels of oil a day. But as we continue the driving tour, Turner explains they could produce a lot more.
It's all a matter of money to get it out.
Money the government has proven unwilling to invest. But Teapot Dome, the oil field, was never supposed to make money for the government. When it was set aside in 1915, it was intended to be a strategic petroleum reserve for the Navy. But when Interior Secretary Albert Fall came into office in 1921, he had other plans for the field. Plans that would prove lucrative for him.
Little suitcases full of cash started appearing in Albert Fall's office, obviously not just left there by accident.
That's Wyoming historian Phil Roberts. Harry Sinclair and Ed Doheny, the country's two most powerful oilmen, left the suitcases, buying them exclusive drilling rights to the nation's naval petroleum reserves. Fall eventually went to jail for the exchange, but neither of the oil executives did. That impunity, Roberts says, cemented the scandal's most enduring legacy.
It created a good deal of public suspicion about the motives of big oil companies and how big oil companies try very hard to control politicians or to buy politicians.
A suspicion that lingers, even today. Robert says looking at it through a historical lens, the government's plan to auction off the field to a private company should raise some red flags.
Rather more openly and blatantly than the way Doheny and Sinclair were going about it, but essentially trying to gain private profit over a public resource.
A top-rating oil field, like industry, within the government system is often frustrating, very frustrating. So I won't miss that part at all.
That's Clark Turner again. After working at Teapot Dome for 25 years, he thinks oil drilling should be left to the oil companies. He says the field will be more productive in private hands. In the last century, only 10% of Teapot Dome's oil has been extracted. Turner says a private company using new oil recovery technologies could get much more.
There has been a lot of interest in the field. A lot of companies have been calling over the last year.
The Department of Energy has already started auctioning off Teapot Dome's equipment. The field itself will be auctioned in the fall. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Stephanie Joyce.
The Mountain West Conference Track and Field Championships are taking place in Laramie this weekend. Shot putter and discus thrower Mason Finley is certainly a headliner. While Finley wants to do well this weekend, he also has his eyes on some upcoming meets. It's a cold, overcast spring day in Laramie with light snow flurries. But University of Wyoming All-American discus thrower Mason Finley does not notice. Finley is working on his footwork and technique as he practices under the watchful eye of his coach, Paul Barrett. Finley is what you might call big. He is 6'8 and weighs about 400 pounds, but you can also see that he's very nimble. Barrett says that's what sets him apart.
His body coordination is kind of off the charts for his size, so it's kind of pretty rare. Most big guys are not real mobile.
Finley says his focus is not on his strength, but on his technique. Part of the reason he doesn't have to muscle it is because the discus looks like a small sandwich plate in his hand. But when you watch him throw, you understand that there's a lot of grace to his footwork and the spin before he releases the discus.
Good. Yeah. Good. Things are just get the shoes out of the back, grab it. Yeah.
There's also not much noise when Finley throws. There's not the grunting you'd hear from a shot putter. It's all about how he's able to spin his body to hurl the roughly 4.5-pound disc as far as he can. Relaxation is another big part of it.
And just trust that my technique is going to work and all my training is going to pay off. We don't really need to muscle it to get these big throws.
The strategy has certainly worked out. Finley has been named an All-American multiple times, and he's dominated Mountain West competition this season. His best throw is 210 feet 6 inches. Coach Paul Barrett says this requires attention to detail and some specific preparation.
Do a strength conditioning for power and speed, and we do some jumping, some short sprints, and then we have technical days where we work the implement. And sometimes, at different times of the year, we work a heavier implement as well, which kind of helps, again, the competition weight lighter. We go over video each week.
Barrett says while the Mountain West Championship is nice, he says his pupil has much larger goals. He says Finley is one of a handful of people who could be the NCAA champion. Nevertheless, Finley still wants to put on a show at his home track.
I mean, if the conditions are right and I'm feeling good, we're going to go for it anyway, you know?
It's home.
Yep.
It's your home meet. You want to, you're close to the school record.
Yep. Yeah, about 4 inches off, I think, or something. Yeah.
So you're aware of that.
Yep.
And that's something you'd like to have.
Yep. Definitely.
Next up are the NCAA and USA track and field championships. He admits he's been thinking about those meets a lot.
I know I'm going to get in the top three for sure. And, you know, I got a shot at taking it.
His coach, Paul Barrett, is even more confident.
He's actually proved his discus mark each and every meet we've had, like every single meet. So obviously his confidence is coming up. So I think he's in a prime situation.
And after this year, there's a little something called the Olympics. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Bob Beck. When we come back, we'll hear an interesting story about a group of women known as the Geo Wives. This is Open Spaces. Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Bob Beck. 60 years ago, a group of women in Casper, whose husbands were always leaving them for long shifts out on the oil patch, got together to commiserate and lunch. The group became known as the GeoWives, Wives of Geologists, and it's celebrating its diamond anniversary this spring. Wyoming Public Radio's Irina Zhurov attended the GeoWives monthly luncheon and has this story.
Betty Faust is one of the charter members of the GeoWives and a Wyoming native who came to Casper in the 1950s.
I had two little girls and a house. I was active in civic things. I was active in politics behind the scenes. I was just a typical, busy, educated housewife.
She says many of the women who arrived in Casper were educated do-gooders, but this group was envisioned as a strictly social club.
We just come and we laugh and we talk and we have fashion shows.
Our conversation is cut short by the beginning of the day's program. Yes, a fashion show. A member who that day is wearing glittery tights invited the designers and young models to entertain the group.
Welcome, welcome. Now, can you hear me?
And Faust is glad, too, because she doesn't really want to be talking to me anyway. She's there to see the girls, as they all call each other.
I'm 93, yes. And I've been a caregiver for my husband for 14 years, and I'm exhausted. I'm just a shadow of myself.
Thank you.
I really am.
But you're still out here.
Yeah, I try.
Why is that important for you?
Oh, I love people, don't you? I'm a people person.
As the fashion show starts up, the women I'm sitting with joke about picking out an outfit for the upcoming dance they're planning with the Wyoming Geological Association. That's the male counterpart to the GeoWives. The clothes, made by a young local designer, sculptural and, well, perhaps a little risque for some of those present. One flowing gown is white and a little see-through.
Very interesting. She said she forgot her slip.
After all, the youngest girls there are in their 50s.
People think, oh, these are women who lunch, you know, they have fashion shows, and they, you know, have a good time.
That's Nimi McConaughey. She arrived in Casper in 1976 from India by way of Singapore, and she hated it. GeoWives helped.
It's a healthier way than hitting the bars, I think. You know, if you can, and it's certainly cheaper than going to a psychiatrist, if you can meet another woman who's got a husband in the field and is alone or has lost her husband or has lived here through boom and bust, what better support can you get from somebody who's been on the same journey?
McConaughey sometimes gets frustrated with the exclusively social aspirations of the club, but she says many of the women who arrived in Casper with their husbands, like she did, without knowing anybody, eventually joined the GeoWives just to have a place to complain and seek solidarity. It's a unique kind of sisterhood. Mary McPherson, who joined GeoWives 3 years ago, agrees.
They all understand about the transferring, the ups and downs, the cyclicity of the industry, the terminology, they understand that. And they've just got really great stories about the old days of being out on the wells and perhaps sleeping in cars, you know, while their husbands are logging a well and stuff like that. And so it's really interesting.
Her husband works in the energy industry, but she herself is a geologist too. In that way, she's unique.
I've encountered situations where I've been in small towns working in oil fields and, you know, like been one of the only women that was, you know, was associated with a property or whatever. And women, you know, white spouses of some of my coworkers and stuff, they may have been curious about me. Because, you know, there was a time when I was one of only six women earth scientists in all of Chevron USA. So we were an oddity.
McPherson was only able to join GeoWives once she retired. Tuesday afternoon lunches, after all, aren't ideal for working women. In this way, the group is showing its age. Liz King, who's been a member since 1975, says it's hard to attract young members.
So many of the younger women that come to town are working women. And that's the way our culture has moved.
She says 20 or 30 years ago, membership was over 100. Today, it's closer to 70, but not everyone is very active. But sisterhood isn't about quantity. It's about the strength of the bonds. And everyone agrees, those bonds are as special as the girls who form them. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Irina Zhurov.
Writer Tamara Lindsay grew up on a ranch in northern Wyoming. She channels that experience in a new collection of short stories, How to Be a Man. As Lindsay explains to Wyoming Public Radio's Micah Schweitzer, the stories grew out of her own struggles with identity and gender.
There are a lot of women in the West who want to be men because they look around themselves and they see that being a man is the way to have respect. Women don't have respect. And so they do everything they can to try and be a man. They wear men's clothes. They watch a lot of football. They drink beer. They hunt. They drive pickup trucks. And there's nothing in and of itself that's bad about that. I think that's wonderful if that's what they want to do. But a lot of times on the inside, they're denying who they essentially are. So they look at men and they go, okay, how can I be a man? Well, they can't actually be a man, but they're definitely not a woman because women have no respect. And so they think of themselves as this weird third gender almost, and that's detrimental if you deny who you essentially are. You spend all your time and all your energy working against yourself.
This seems like a good place for you to read the very opening of the book, if you could read that first paragraph.
Never acknowledge the fact that you're a girl and take pride when your guy friends say, you're one of the guys. Tell yourself, I am one of the guys, even though in the back of your mind a little voice says, but you've got girl parts.
And this really gets at what you're saying, that masculinity becomes a standard. And this book is not only about girls and women. There are also male characters. But regardless of the sex of the character, they're denying or struggling with accepting their feminine side.
Yeah. I was thinking in a broader sense that it's about self-acceptance. In general, they're trying to find a place in the world where they can have self-respect or where they can connect with other people. Often the stories are about little moments, the small moments when we just have a small connection with someone or the small moments where we do small violences to each other.
Another theme seems to be this idea that work and societal roles matter more than who we are as individuals. So this idea that doing is more important than being.
Absolutely. That's a very strong idea that I grew up with, and I think it's very strong in the West, that we get our self-worth by what we accomplish, by what we can contribute. I know in my own life, it took me a long time to get over that, you know, a lot of my self-worth wasn't just what I could accomplish. And it makes sense. I mean, your survival in the West depends on how much you work and how much how much fence you can fix and how much you can, go out in the storm and take care of a cow that's calving. It's very, very intricately linked to each other.
You say it's taken a long time to overcome
that.
How have you done that?
I think by first initially accepting the fact that I am female and I can be proud of that. I am proud of that. I accept who I am now. And I think it helped coming to college. Coming to the university, I started questioning things that I took for granted that I just assumed about life, and that really helped me to understand and have self-worth.
So, Tamara Lindsay, how has your family reacted to reading these stories inspired by growing up on a ranch? Because there's a real closeness to this ranch life. I mean, these are vignettes mm-hmm. from the Western life, from Wyoming and for the most part. And there is an affection, certainly, in them. But there's also a distance and also sort of, that critical distance.
I think that's the story of my life is I'm ambivalent about my upbringing. I mean, I love it when I think about the Pryor Mountains and being out on a horse. It is so beautiful up there. I love it in so many ways, but also I hate it. I mean, there was so many challenges, certainly gender, but all kinds of other challenges as well. I mean, I was in between generations, so I was alone a lot. I didn't have a lot of friends, and I was intensely lonely. And so I am deeply ambivalent about the whole thing. And so I think my family has always known that I was ambivalent about it. You know, I do not romanticize the cowboy life.
You've talked about how college opened your eyes. Who's this book meant for? Who should read this?
It's easy to say everyone, but
that's good for sales.
That's good for sales. It's interesting. I did a Goodreads giveaway of the book, and I'm giving away 20 copies. And people signed up from across the world, you know, Mauritius, India, Indonesia, Great Britain, all kinds of places. I think the myth of the cowboy is infinitely attractive to everybody in the world. But there's other parts of the whole Western cowboy society that hasn't been explored and hasn't been talked about very much. And so I think it's for people who are looking for the West today, what the legacy of that cowboy way of life is, women and men. And also there's some class and economic stuff going on. I mean, there are people who are really trying to make it, and they might see themselves in this book.
These gender issues that you explore in How to Be a Man, are these Western gender issues or are they more universal?
They're certainly Western, but they are more universal. Malcolm Gladwell has a great book. He talks about how herding societies have this masculine-dominated mindset. And there's a whole series of sort of characteristics that go along with this. And the West certainly is a herding society, has the legacy of a herding society. And it has all these characteristics he talks about. There are some great things about that legacy as well. I mean, we have some men who are very tough. We have women who are very tough. We had to be in order to be able to make it. But then again, it's got its dark side, which is that the individual, the personal, the emotional gets left behind.
Tamara Lindsay is the author of a new collection of short stories, How to Be a Man. Thanks so much for talking with me.
Thank you. It's been such an honor. Thank you, Micah.
That's our program for this month. If you would like to hear it again or hear individual segments, we invite you to go to our website at wyomingpublicmedia.org. There you can sign up for our podcast, listen to old programs, and submit comments. Anna Rader is our web editor. We also invite you to become a fan of our Wyoming Public Radio News Facebook page, and we invite you to follow Stephanie Joyce and me on Twitter. You can find me under the name Butter Bob. Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.